Welcome to Oak City Church, a family of learners, lovers, and givers sent. For more information, visit us online at oakcitychurch.com. Let us know if we can help you in any way. Thank you for listening.
Today we'll be reading Matthew 9, 35 through 38. And Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every disease and every affliction. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them, because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks. All right, you guys can have a seat. One more announcement. So it's the 23rd. Next week is the 30th. The following week is July 7th. We will not be having a Sunday morning service on July 7th. It's just something that we've done forever as a church. If you're new to Oak City, in just knowing that everyone's going to be out of town, this is okay. And giving our staff a break and our volunteers and everything. So we will have service next week. It was unfortunate that the 4th falls like in the middle of the week, so we know no one's going to be here either week. But we will not be having service on the 7th. We will be having service next week, so be here next week. But on the 7th, we will not be having a Sunday morning service. Okay, I saw something that I considered like a minor miracle this week. This is in the news. Did anybody else see something that they thought, man, that's crazy that happened? Okay, this was it. Do we have a picture? There's at least one thing that Gavin Newsom and Ron DeSantis may agree on. Come on, I thought that was like miraculous. Now, if you don't know who those people are, Gavin Newsom is the Democratic governor of California, and Ron DeSantis is the Republican governor of Florida. They're probably the two most influential governors right now. In an alternate reality, they might be the candidates for president this fall, which I don't know. I think that, I'm not sure if that's good or bad. I'm going to let my cynicism and exhaustion and utter disbelief about the state of our politics right now bleed through on purpose for just a second, because it's comically almost unbelievable to me that these are the candidates that we have for president, that this is where we are right now. And so I don't know, maybe these guys would be better. I've said this for years, that in a democracy, and I guess we're technically a federal republic, somebody can correct me on this afterwards, but in the sense that we elect our officials, in a place where you elect your officials, the candidates aren't the problem. The candidates are just the character of the candidates is a reflection of the character of the country. Right, the character of the candidates is a reflection of the character of the country. So the problem isn't the candidates, the problem is us. And if we weren't us, then the candidates. We had a reality TV president for 4 years and may have for another 4 years because we are a reality TV people. And so if we fix us, then we fix the rest of this. And our hope isn't in an election. Our hope is in the gospel of Jesus changing people, changing us one by one, and then that's going to change things. So I don't mention that for no reason. I'll come back to it in just a second. But that was what I saw. And here's the thing that they agreed on, that cell phones should not be allowed in school classrooms. This is what Newsom and DeSantis agreed on, and we're trying to get legislation towards, which is, that should have been obvious to us. We could be forgiven because phones have been new, you know, and we didn't know what was going to happen. But about a month ago, I had a conversation with my three older kids and ask them, like, what's it been like to have, like, you guys are the first people and hopefully the last, like, age that's going to have had phones. They're going to look back on this in 20 years and be like, you guys won't believe this, but they let us have phones in the classroom for about 10 years. Like, can you believe they did that? And they're like, oh, yeah, it's crazy. Like, people are on their phones all the time. They're hiding them in their textbooks. They're hiding them behind their lunchbox. Like, they're always looking at their phones, which, of course, they are, and teachers can only do so much to do that, you know? And I don't think my kids told me this. I read this somewhere that, like, the dynamic of social media being, like, constant. And so at lunch, if something happened on social media during the morning and you don't know what it is, then like you're behind at lunch. So you have to keep up even during your morning classes because you don't want to be behind. And then we just have an inability to not look at our phones. Like we're all kind of addicted to our phones. I mean, it's Sunday morning. You want to look at your phone right now, don't you? Like just you do. And thank you for being honest. And last week, John was preaching. So I was out there and I didn't look at my phone, but I wanted to a couple times. And like sometimes when I'm preaching, if I know my sermon well enough and I'm kind of on autopilot mode, I kind of want to glance at my phone. I mean, it's just where who we are and where we are. And so our kids will look back on this, like, what were you thinking letting us have fun? And they're already doing this. I found something this week called the log off movement. And it was a high school senior, she's now in college, that is like, well, it's all right, fine. We'll take matters into our own hands if the adults won't be the adults and find a way to get kids off their phones. So this week, along those lines, the Surgeon General, did anybody see this? The Surgeon General of the United States, who is like the most important doctor in the United States, put an op-ed in the New York Times, which is arguably the most influential newspaper in the United States, urging Congress to put a Surgeon General's warning label like we have on cigarettes, on social media. So like when you log on to social media, a thing would pop up that says, this is bad for your mental health. That's amazing that the Surgeon General, who I have no idea what his politics are, if he has strong politics, whatever, but this has become the apolitical issue where we're having such a mental health crisis, it's particularly amongst our young people, that the Surgeon General wants to do this. He, and similar to the politics thing, that like where the candidates aren't the problem, we are the problem. The technology isn't the problem. The technology just reflects something about us. It tends to enhance the things that are good, but maybe enhance more the things that are bad. So in that op-ed, he says this after talking to a group of teenagers. He said, after they talked about what they liked about social media, a way to stay in touch with old friends, find communities of shared identity, and express themselves creatively, a young woman named Tina raised her hand. I just don't feel good when I use social media, she said softly, a hint of embarrassment in her voice. Her confession opened the door for her classmates. One by one, they spoke about their experiences with social media, the endless comparison with other people that shredded their self-esteem, the feeling of being addicted and unable to set limits, and the difficulty having real conversations on platforms that too often fostered outrage and bullying. There was a sadness in their voices, as if they knew what was happening to them, but they felt powerless to change it. Like, so powerful. And the problem isn't the technology. We're the problem underneath the problem. Like, it's exposed some good. There's some good, but there's also just a lot of bad in it. I found a quote when I was looking at this from Thoreau, who was in, like, the late 1800s. Are there any English majors in here? I don't know. On what is it? On Walden Pond? Is that it? It's out in the middle of the woods. He had this quote. We do not ride on the railroad. It rides upon us. And what he was lamenting is that what we believe to be advancements, like railroads actually complicate our lives and make us their slaves. Like it happens again and again and again. The guy ends it towards the end of this op-ed. He says, there's no seatbelt for parents to click, no helmet to snap in place, no assurance that trusted experts have investigated and ensured that these platforms are safe for our kids. There are just parents and their children trying to figure it out on their own, pitted against some of the best product engineers and most well-resourced companies in the world. And that is the perfect description of what's going on right now, you know? Okay. So the reason I bring all this stuff up, we're in the last week of a series called Encounters with Jesus. We looked at different interactions that Jesus had with a bunch of characters in the Gospels. And this week, I want to look at Jesus' interactions with the crowds. I want to look at the crowds as a character because they are as frequent a character, maybe more so than anybody else, than any other character in the Gospels, but they're kind of underneath the surface. And I start by talking about our politics and social media because I think those are two of the biggest ways that we interact with the crowds in our lives today. And so the word for crowd in Greek is akhlos. I guess we have English words. Akhlophobia is an irrational or maybe perfectly rational fear of crowds, akhlophobia. and ochlocracy, which is a mob rule. A government by the wild populace as opposed to a carefully structured people of a democracy, which it might be a bit generous right now. And ochlos is used over 100 times in the Gospels. So compared to any of the characters that we've gone through, this probably shows up more than almost all of them. And so let me just start. I'm gonna skim through a handful of passages. There's a few that I'll spend a little bit of time in, but not a ton. There's so many of them. And I'm just gonna say a few things about crowds as I get started. One, there's nothing wrong with the crowd. The crowd is not the problem. And so this is Matthew 15. Jesus went on from there, walked beside the Sea of Galilee, went up to the mountain and sat down, and great crowds came to him, bringing with them the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others. They put them at his feet, and Jesus healed them so that the crowd wondered. And when they saw the mute speaking, the crippled healthy, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and the crowd glorified the God of Israel. Nothing wrong with the crowds. They're like amoral, just like technology. There can be good and there can be bad. They're not the problem. Matthew 22, when the crowd heard it, they were astonished at the teaching of Jesus. Mark 9, when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw Jesus, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. The crowds are something that Jesus used to show the world who he was and to communicate the message that he was here for. Crowds have power. Crowds have power. So this is a scene, Matthew 21. This is the last week of Jesus' life. The tension is building between Jesus and the religious leaders. They're trying to find some way to trap him. And he comes into the temple, and the chief priests and elders come up to him and say, "By what authority are you doing these things? Who gave you this authority?" Because authority is a big deal. And like, he's a rabbi, but he's outside the system. They have a system that gives authority to them. You'd be someone else's disciple, and then you'd have their authority. But Jesus' authority came straight from his Father. And so they're like, "Well, whose authority are you doing this by?" And Jesus answers them and says, "I'll ask you one question. If you tell me the answer, then I'll answer your question." And his question was the baptism of John. So John the Baptist, precursor of Jesus, from where did it come from? From heaven or from man? Like, who gave John the Baptist the authority? And they know they're in trouble because there was a debate about that. They didn't like John the Baptist because he preached against the religious leaders. And so, but the people liked John the Baptist. So is it legitimate from heaven or was it illegitimate just from man? And as they discussed it among themselves, saying, "If we say from heaven, he'll say, well, why didn't you believe him? Because John the Baptist affirmed Jesus. But if we say from man, we are afraid of the crowd, for they all hold that John was a prophet." And so Jesus pins them in using the power of the crowd, because they know the power of the crowd, and Jesus knows the power of the crowd, and how it will turn things. And so they answered, "We don't know." And he said, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things." The crowds have power. One article I read this week was from Arianna Huffington. Here's something I never thought I would do in a sermon, is quote Arianna Huffington. But she was writing about crowds, and this was fascinating to me. She said, "At a deeper, more philosophical level, identity politics is where a post-religion, post-philosophy, post-truth, post-modern world goes to find its source of belief and morality. She says, "We know our beliefs and morality are all socially constructed. God is dead, capital T, truth is too." So this is where she's coming from. And this is where much of the world is coming from, if not like, if they wouldn't get it, like functionally where they're coming from, that God doesn't, we're not looking to God, most of the world, for any sorts of morality or truth. Like we're post-modern, we're post-truth. We're making it up as we go along. And she says, like, if that's true, she says, "Yet we still need something to believe, some moral standards to guide our lives. But where do we get them?" And she says, "From our tribe. From the crowd. Our tribe gives us meaning, purpose, value, a code. People live and identify with their tribes, even if those tribes coexist in a perpetual state of war like a Mad Max movie. In the more radical view, our very sense of self is determined by the conversations we have within our tribe. There's no I. What we think of as I or myself is a composite of all the tribes we inhabit, the values and words we learn from this family, that ethnic identity, that nation, that high school, that professional group, and so forth. And that's the power of the crowd, is to tell people who they are. Like, that's power. I forget what article I was reading where I got this, but he was referencing a book that was written 120 years ago called The Psychology of the Crowds. It says this: having no doubts about what it believes to be truth and or error, and possessing a clear idea of its strength, the crowd is as authoritarian as it is intolerant. It's a perfect encapsulation of our current social media world, except it was written 120 years ago. Mobs and the surrender of reason and judgment to group outrage have always been with us. We can find examples throughout history, but technology, and especially social media, have amplified the most negative elements of our social wiring in ways that make it increasingly hard for us to access the more positive aspects of our social instincts. Now we've ceded our public conversation and the psychological levers of our deepest social impulses to technology. One guy called it the greatest psychological experiment we've ever run on humanity. And the result is that we're perpetually hypervigilant in hypervigilant fight or flight mode, signaling our tribal loyalty by looking for our enemies. I thought, man, that's a great description of what's going on right now. So the crowds have power, and as much now as at any point, the crowds have power. Crowds are fickle. So I think probably the best example in the Gospels of this is the contrast between Palm Sunday and Good Friday. So Palm Sunday is the day that Jesus comes into Jerusalem for Holy Week. They get the donkey, and he gets on the donkey, and it says the crowds spread their cloaks on the road. Others cut branches from the trees, spread them on the road. And the crowds that went before him and that followed him were shouting, "Hosanna to the Son of David. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest." The crowds are all shouting this to Jesus. When he entered Jerusalem, the whole city was stirred up saying, "Who is this?" And the crowd said, "It's the prophet Jesus from Nazareth of Galilee." So they're celebrating him. A few days later, the Garden of Gethsemane, when he gets arrested, at that hour, Jesus said to the crowds, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day, I sat in the temple teaching and you didn't seize me." It's the crowds that come for him. At the trials of Jesus, the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to destroy Jesus. They moved the crowd. The governor again said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" And they said, "Barabbas." And Pilate said, "Well, what should I do with Jesus, who's called Christ?" And they said, "Let him be crucified." He said, "Why? What evil has he done?" They shouted, "All the more, let him be crucified." The crowds have turned. And then at the cross, it says the centurion saw what had taken place, and he praised God, saying, "Certainly this man who we just killed was innocent." And all the crowds that had assembled for this spectacle, when they saw what had taken place, returned home beating their breasts. The crowds are fickle. They'll flip-flop back and forth. And yet, the crowds act in a predictable fashion. So let me ask you this. What motivates a crowd today? What motivates a crowd today? Or maybe what motivates us to join a crowd?
Injustice.
Injustice. Pardon me?
Acceptance.
Acceptance.
Popularity.
Popularity.
Politics. Belonging.
Belonging.
Peer pressure.
Peer pressure. Yeah. My first one was like safety in numbers, affirmation, peer pressure, belonging, all those things. My second one that I wrote down was fear. Like, that's the way to motivate a crowd, is fear, is to appeal to that fight or flight instinct. Twitter is my social media drug of choice. And when you get on it, you put your things you follow, and you can categorize them. So I follow sports, basically, on Twitter, a little bit of news and some church stuff. But it automatically comes up to a For You section, no matter what you do, which is so annoying. And the algorithm just sends you some stuff. And some of it is, like, historical stuff that, like, gets me. There was one last night on castles. I'm like, oh, yeah, I like castles. But a lot of it is just fight or flight fear. Can you believe they did this type of stuff? And then the other one I put is money. And all that goes along with it, status, security, comfort. You promise somebody that you can draw a crowd. And there's something predictable about it. One of the most fascinating things I've read in years is an article by a guy named Malcolm Gladwell. He wrote it 9 years ago about school shootings. And his theory about school shootings is that it is a slow motion riot. That it is a mob scene, like just in slow motion. It's in the New Yorker. It's a fascinating article. And he starts with like the early shooters and Columbine, Harris and Klebold. I can't remember their first names. And then he just goes through different people in their writings and like what motivated them and how they're really following the leader, but the leader wasn't following anybody. And he has one that's, it starts it with and ends it with a kid in Minnesota who someone saw him walk into a storage unit and they thought something's off with that. And they caught the kid before he could do anything. And it was just a bizarre, he was somewhere on the spectrum. He was a little bit off. But like the kid was going to kill his folks, but he loved his folks. Like he really liked him. It was just, that was what the script was. And so he does this thing. And so he writes a few things about this that I'm going to read. He said that this, a guy's quoting, was most taken by the situations in which people did things for social reasons that went against everything they believed it is as individuals. And that's the power of the crowd. We will do things for social reasons that went against everything they believed as individuals. Most did not think it right to commit illegal acts or even want to do so, he wrote about the findings of the study of delinquent boys, but group interaction was such that none could admit this without a loss of status. In our terms, their threshold for stealing cars is low because daring masculine acts bring status, and reluctance to join, once others have joined, carries the high cost of being labeled a sissy. You can't just look at an individual's norms and motives. You need to look at the group. And so he looks at this as a group. He said, the kid who wants to be a chef, and this is one of these shooters, and hears non-specific, non-violent voices, requires a finely elaborated script in order to carry out an attack, a shooting. The effect of Harris and Klebold, the Columbine shooter's example, was to make it possible for people with far higher thresholds, boys who would never ordinarily thinking of firing a weapon at their classrooms, to join the riot because someone had gone before them. Between Columbine and Aaron Ybarra, had a shooting in the Northwest, I think in Seattle, the riot changed. It became more and more self-referential, more ritualized, more and more about identification with the school shooting tradition. Eric Harris wanted to start a revolution. Aguilar and Ybarra wanted to join a revolution. Harris saw himself as a hero. The others were hero worshipers. And so he says it works in a predictable fashion. You can see where a crowd is going. Maybe my favorite crowd story in the New Testament is in the book of Acts. It's in Acts chapter 19. Paul and his guys are in Ephesus. Ephesus has the Temple of Artemis. The Temple of Artemis is one of the seven wonders of the ancient world where they worship the goddess Artemis. And so Demetrius is a guy that makes these little shrines for Artemis and realizes all that what Paul has done in other cities and what he's starting to do in Ephesus threatens all their business. And so it's almost like if your town has a sports team and the owner threatens to move the team, like when St. Louis lost their football team, or when San Diego lost the Chargers, or when Oakland loses everybody, like all their teams move out, you know? And you think, well, how much are we going to lose? That's kind of what this is. So this guy calls together all the craftsmen in similar trades and says, men, you know that from this business we have our wealth. You see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods, which seems like a fairly obvious statement, you know? But he's stirring up these guys. He's the leader. He's going to stir up a few guys. He says there's danger not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing, and that she may even be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all of Asia and the world worship. And so he appeals to fear. He appeals to money. You guys are going to end up broke if Paul keeps going like this. He names an enemy. It says when they heard this, they were enraged and were crying out, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. So the city was filled with confusion. They rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, who were Paul's guys, Paul's companions. They found the enemy. And it says, when Paul wished to go in among the crowd, the disciples wouldn't let him. And even some of the Asiarchs, who were friends of his, sent to him and were urging him not to go into the theater. Now, some cried one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion. And I love this. Most of them did not know why they had come together. Just you got a crowd screaming for hours. They have no idea why, because it's like one person started it, got a couple people worked up. They get everybody scared, but nobody knows why they're there. This is a movie a few years ago where the quote was, "Loud noises. I don't know why I'm yelling." Like, I don't know why. I was at a Packers game years ago in Lambeau Field. They were playing the Steelers, and we're in one end zone. It's the end of the game. It's the last play of the game. The Steelers are driving down the other end. I think their quarterback was Bubby Brister at the time, and he throws a pass to Yancey Thigpen, and Yancey Thigpen catches the ball and brings it in, and the Steelers score, and it's the end of the game. But then everybody on that side of the stadium starts cheering. We're in Green Bay. And then it's like the wave happens, but everybody starts cheering around on our end. And we have no idea why they're cheering, because they just caught the touchdown and we just lost the game. But you know what we were doing? We were cheering because everybody else was cheering. And then on the video screen, you saw that Yancey Thigpen brought the ball in, bounced it off his knee, went out the end zone on the other side. We just couldn't see what had happened yet. But we're cheering because everybody else is cheering. That just feels like so much of our world right now. Like, I'm mad. What are you mad about? I don't know. Just like being mad. Want to be mad. They're mad, and so we should be mad. Like, it's social media. It's so much of our politics. It's Twitter. It's the 24-hour news cycle runs on fear. Like, to get us to watch, they got to make us afraid of something. It's not that there aren't things to be afraid of, but everything is magnified. In this scene, for about 2 hours, they all cried out with one voice, "Great is the Artemis of the Ephesians." And then I'm going to read a little bit on my own and then the end. But this is how it ended. The town clerk, when the town clerk had quieted the crowd, the town clerk, which sounds like someone from like Parks and Rec or like Dwight Schrute or something like that, walks in and says, "Men of Ephesus, who is there that does not know that the city of the Ephesians is the temple keeper of the great Artemis, the one and of the sacred stone that fell from the sky? Seeing then that these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rash, for you've brought these guys in here who haven't done anything wrong. If Demetrius and his craftsmen have a complaint against anyone, the courts are open, there's proconsuls, let them bring charges against one another. But if you seek anything further, it shall be settled in the regular assembly, for we really are in danger of being charged with rioting today." Like 2 hours of screaming, and this like little guy comes in with his glasses to say, "Hey guys, we could get in trouble, and there's no cause to justify this commotion." And when he'd said these things, he dismissed the assembly. And the crowd is like, "Oh, okay, all right, see ya, bye." Like, and they just go home. In the article by Malcolm Gladwell, and talking to the kid in Minnesota who got arrested, they didn't even know, they couldn't really charge him because he hadn't done anything wrong yet. He just planned it. He was kind of like that. Like, "Oh, why are you doing this?" "I don't know. I really love my parents. But, like, it's kind of what you have to do if you're going to do this." Like, what are you doing? And someone needed to pull it back and say, "What are you doing?" Crowds are predictably motivated and predictably fickle. And it doesn't mean the town clerk doesn't need to stand up and say something or that Paul should back down. It's not that. But there is some element of crowds are going to crowd. And you just got to know what's going to happen. So here's a few things for us. Be aware of the crowd. The crowd is a character. It's its own character in your story. The crowd is always seeking to name you. The crowd is always vying for your attention. The crowd is wooing you with something, and the crowd wants you scared and angry. And you are susceptible to the crowd. Like, we are motivated by fear. I was reading in Corinthians this week, or in Acts, and Paul was in Corinth, and one of my favorite little passages, there's this strange, it's no context given to it, but the Lord comes to Paul and says, "Do not be afraid." Whenever God comes to someone and says, "Do not be afraid," it's the most common command in the Bible, is "Do not be afraid." And Paul, you just don't get the impression he's afraid a lot, but he was afraid, or God wouldn't have told him that. And it's because someone was working up a crowd against him. And God ends up saying, "I have many people in this city. My work isn't done here yet. I know what's going on. Do not be afraid." And in the midst of everything that's going on, I think, like, we need to hear that. I am as concerned about this election as I have ever been about it. Elections used to be fun for me. I wish this election would not happen. I don't know what I want to happen, but it's not it. Matt Noble and I were talking about this probably a year ago, and he suggested this, and I've thought a lot about it, that we shouldn't just look at our politics on a spectrum of right and left, of conservative and liberal, but we should put another axis on there of authoritarian and non-authoritarian, of people that are going to abuse power to keep power, like all over the world happens, and people that will just let the system run its course. And so you've got people on the right that are authoritarian and non-authoritarian, and people on the left that are authoritarian and non-authoritarian. And I am more scared about the authoritarian, non-authoritarian axis than I am about the other one. And but 2016 happened, and we're still here. It's okay. And 2020 happened, and we're still here. And 2024 is going to happen, and we'll probably still be here in 2028. You know, like, the likelihood is that. At some point, it won't. But God will be in charge of that too. And he knows what's going to happen. We're motivated by that. We're motivated by safety and numbers. We're motivated by status and security and comfort. We're motivated to keep up with the Joneses. If they got one, we should probably have one too. I don't know why, but it looks like fun, so we should do it. If you find yourself in the midst of the crowd and on the outside you're shouting and really worked up, but on the inside you're not quite sure what you're shouting about, you're in a bad place. This log off movement would do all of us some good, of tuning out, of logging off, of spending some time with the Lord, of spending some time thinking for ourselves. I think about my counsel to my kids over the years, with both like what's going on in culture, but also with just spiritual stuff, and in particular with their schools and stuff. I'll ask them like what they're being taught and stuff like that. But even when I tell them what I think about a given topic, I'll be like, but you should think for yourself. Like, you should go, you should know there's three sides to every story, my side, your side, and the truth. And you should learn to think for yourself and look into it. And just don't take what everybody tells you at face value, because there's more to it. Even, I can remember when they were little, spiritually, like telling them about Jesus, but at some point telling them, hey, not everybody believes this. I mean, they're obviously really young when I told them that, because I don't want them to follow Jesus just because the crowd that is everybody in their life, or they think that, because someday they're going to find out that the crowd is doing something different and they might follow the crowd in that direction. And following the crowd, if you believe just because you followed the crowd, you don't really believe. And I realized as I told them that, there was some trepidation in me telling them not everybody believes this. And that part of me is the part that was using the crowd in a way, or was afraid that without the crowd pushing in a positive direction, that it was all going to fall apart and not work. Be aware of the crowd and how the crowd shapes us. Beware of the crowd. Be wary of the crowd. Another great crowd story is the feeding of the 5,000. Jesus feeds the 5 or 10 or 15,000, how many ever it is, and after he teaches them. And then that night, the disciples go across the Lake of Sea of Galilee in a boat, and Jesus walks after them, and the crowd gets up and realizes Jesus isn't there. They put two and two together that he walked across the thing, and so they walk around the lake, they catch up to him at lunch, and they're like, hey, Jesus, look at that. It's about lunchtime. What are you doing for lunch, Jesus? You know? And Jesus says to him, truly, truly, I say to you, you're seeking me not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves. And so the crowd was following Jesus for what Jesus could do for the crowds. And Jesus does this all the time, diagnoses that, and disperses the crowd. So if that's how you follow me, you're not really following me. There's a line in the church leadership world where what you win people with is what you win people to. And so if you win people with health and wealth, or you win people with the show, like, then you got another step to like get them to really to Jesus. And Jesus says to this group, do not work for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. For on him, God the Father has set his seal. Like, you are not following me for the right reasons. You don't come to Jesus in a crowd. We come to Jesus one by one. You don't come to Jesus because you're scared. I didn't grow up going to camp I started going to camps, like working them when I was a youth pastor. Some of you had this experience that we were out in the middle of Virginia, campfire, lots of kids, and there's like a little kind of country-ish preacher comes, and he's young guy, youth pastor, and he's preaching about hell, which is fine. Hell is a real place. We should talk about that. But then he starts screeching like the demons in hell are screeching to a bunch of teenagers at like 10 o'clock at night in front of a campfire. And kids are, like girls are crying. Like lots of people got saved that night, you know, saved that night. But that doesn't work. Like you don't manipulate a crowd to fear and like that do it, you know. Same with money. The health and wealth gospel, like you don't, that's not how people come to Jesus. You manipulate a crowd to say, well, if you follow Jesus, then everything's going to go great. Because Jesus died on a cross and said, follow me and lose your life to save it. Like that's not how it works. You come because he's true and because you need him. And so he starts telling this crowd this, and it says the Jews grumbled about him because he says, I'm the bread that came down from heaven. I'm not giving you bread. I am the bread. It's in this talk where he says, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, a foreshadowing of communion, you have no part of me. And they're like, wait, isn't this Jesus, the son of Joseph? We know his mom and dad. How is he saying this? And he has to be more than someone that just meets my needs. He is God who came from heaven to earth and did the works and died for my sins and rose from the dead. And he's someone I worship and I surrender everything to, whether or not I think my needs are being met in the moment, because he's always meeting our needs. But there's a lot of moments where it doesn't feel like my needs are any of his concern, even if they are. And that's what it is to follow Jesus. And the crowd moves on emotions, but the emotions aren't always going to be good emotions. It says, after this, many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. And so he could draw a crowd, but he just as quick push away a crowd. He didn't need the crowds. And so Jesus says to the 12, do you want to go away as well? And Simon Peter, the one, answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? That's how you come to Jesus. The crowds go away. It's just you and Jesus. And Jesus says, who do you say that I am? And those are the moments where you come to Jesus. And Peter says, you have the words of eternal life. We have believed and come to know that you are the Holy One of God. To whom else would we go? Like, you're it. And I'll follow you anywhere, no matter who follows you. If no one follows you, I'll follow you. The church has a bad habit of becoming a crowd that works on fear and emotional manipulation. And I found this quote from some notes from a sermon a few years ago from D.A. Carson. He says, what binds us together is not common education, common race, common income levels, common politics, common nationality, common accents, common jobs, or anything of the sort. No crowd dynamic to it. Christians come together not because they form a natural collocation, but because they have been saved by Jesus Christ and owe him a common allegiance. In light of this common allegiance, in light of the fact that they've all been loved by Jesus himself, they commit themselves to doing what he says, and he commands them to love one another. In this light, they're a band of natural enemies who love one another for Jesus' sake. And so in some ways, the church is like the anti-crowd. It's the people that you never would think would be a crowd being a crowd. From time to time, I'll say this. There's no reason that this group of people would be gathered at this time in this place other than the name of Jesus. And that's a fantastic thing. And so the last thing I want to say is love, like, be aware of the crowds, beware of the crowds, but love the crowds. Love the crowds. Jesus went through all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction. And when he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them. His guts turned over for them because he saw they were harassed and they were helpless and they were sheep without a shepherd. And just so much, man, look at the crowds like that, and that's not hard to see. And he said to us, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest and send out laborers into his harvest. And I'm gonna finish. The band can come back up. I'm going to finish with a story. I was talking with Rebecca on Thursday, and Thursday, pretty much all I think about is my sermon because Sunday's coming fast. And And as we were talking, I was reminded of this story, which I hadn't thought about for years. But it was in a book that I got when I was a youth pastor, a little book called How to Speak to Kids and Keep Them Awake. Bar is low. And he told this story about an experiment he did with a bunch of college students that had just graduated. They were going into ministry, and just about like the importance of touch and communication. So they got a group of people in a room, and he's got one person that he sends out of the room, and they blindfold this person. They're going to walk back in the room in a minute. And he says to everybody that's there, like, you guys all need to sit in your seats and just shout at this person. And one of you has the thing that we want them to do. And in this case, it was like, walk to the back of the room. It was like, walk up the steps of the sound booth, and then there's an instructor there. So he's got to hug Matt Gay. He's got to give Matt Gay a hug. That's like the vital instructions are get him to go back there and give Matt Gay a hug. But the person with the vital instructions can only sit with everybody else. And so the person comes in the room, and everybody just starts shouting everything, and like he can't hear anything. And so the person's just confused and doesn't do anything. So they stop the first phase of the experiment. Second phase of the experiment, the person with the vital instructions can now get up out of their seat, and they can come up, and they can get as close as they want to and just start telling the instructions to the person while everybody else is shouting. But then another person gets to get up and also talk to the person and can say whatever that they want to in their other ear, but neither one of them can touch them. So second phase of the experiment, guy comes in, and the vital instruction guy comes up and says, hey, what, you know, we need to go to the back. And everybody's shouting, everything is confusing, and we need to, like, get up the stairs, and we need to go give Matt a hug. But the other person's probably not whispering, no, Matt's a bad guy. You don't want to hug Matt. Like, it's not like that. Like, this is how the devil would do it. No, we need to go over here and give this person a hug. You know what I mean? Like, it'd be real subtle with it. And it still doesn't work. The person's still confused, doesn't know what to do. And then they get to the third part of the experiment. And in the third phase, the person with the vital instructions, the only difference is they have touch. They can touch the person that they're trying to get to do the thing. So this is what he writes. He says, in this phase, everything remained the same except the one with the vital message was allowed to touch the volunteer. He couldn't pull, push, or in any way force the volunteer to do his bidding, but he could touch him and in that way encourage him to follow. The blindfolded volunteer was led into the room. When he appeared, the silence erupted into an ear-splitting roar. The two messengers stood close, shouting their opposing words. Then the one with the vital message put his arm gently around the volunteer's shoulder and leaned in very close to speak directly into his ear. Almost without hesitation, the volunteer began to yield to his instruction. Occasionally, he paused to listen as the opposition frantically tried to convince him to turn around. But then, because of the gentle touch of the one with the vital message, he allowed himself to be guided on. A moment of frightening realism occurred spontaneously as the one with the vital message drew close to the goal. All those in the audience who up to this point had been shouting their own individual instructions suddenly joined in unison to keep the volunteer from taking those final steps. Goosebumps appeared all over my body as students began to chant together, "Don't go, don't go, don't go." And he adds, so many times I've seen the forces that pull our youth in different directions join together to dissuade them from a serious commitment to Christ. The chant grew to a pulsing crescendo, "Don't go, don't go." But the guiding arm of the one with the vital message never left the volunteer's shoulder. At the top of the stairs, at the back of the lecture hall, the one with the vital message leaned one last time to whisper into the ear of the volunteer. There was a moan of hesitation, and then the volunteer threw his arms around the instructor, and the auditorium erupted in cheers and applause. There were more than a few damp eyes in the room, as many of us were touched with the truth of what we had just seen. When the volunteer revealed how he felt as he went through each phase, it became apparent that if our message is to be heard, we cannot shout it from the cavernous confines of our church buildings. We must venture out and draw close to those with whom we wish to communicate. If we really seek a life-changing commitment from our young people, we must also reach out to where they are and in love gently touch them and lead them to that commitment. We asked the volunteer why he followed the one with the vital message, the one who touched him. And after a few minutes, he said, because it felt like he was the only one who really cared. And so I think about that just in the day that we live in and the importance of the message we have. And there are just so many ways where I think pendulums are swinging back and crowds are switching. And they're not as anti the message of the gospel as maybe it seemed like they were going to be. And there's a door open for a message, but we can't just get... I mean, it matters what the crowds are saying, it matters, but it doesn't matter as much as the crowds think it does or our culture thinks it does. And what matters is the message that we have. And the message that's going to change everything is the message that's got to go one by one. And the message is going to go one by one not as we get in the right crowd with the right message, but as we love our co-workers and our neighbors and our family members that don't know Christ, and we're bold with the vital instructions, but we're bold with our love for the people around us. Father, I pray that you would help us in the day that we live in to be aware of how we're being influenced, how we're being frightened, how we're being wooed by the crowds around us, that you'd help us to see through it, the illusion of it, that we would know that you're in control of it, God, that we would know that the things that we need, we have in you, Lord, and that you know what's going to happen, Lord, and that you would use us, to give the one message that matters most to the people that you brought close to us in our lives, Lord. We love you and pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.